Om, repeat after me this. First. Om Mauna Vyakya Prakatita. Om Mauna Vyakya Prakatita. Parabrahma Tattvam Yuvanam. Parabrahma Tattvam Yuvanam. Varshishtante Vasadrishiganaihi. Varshishtante Vasadrishiganaihi. Avritam Brahmanishtai. Avritam Brahmanishtai. Acharyendram Karakalita Chinmudram. Acharyendram Karakalita Chinmudram. Anandamurtim. Anandamurtim. Swatmaramam Muditavadanam. Swatmaramam Muditavadanam. Dakshinamurtimide. Dakshinamurtimide. Okay, we'll do a little bit more in verse 8 we did last week. Okay. We'll just repeat that here. Vishwam Pashyati Karya Karanataya. Vishwam Pashyati Karya Karanataya. Swaswami Sambandataha. Swaswami Sambandataha. Shishacharya Tata. Shishacharya Taya Tataiva. Shishacharya Taya Tataiva. Pitrapudradhyatmana Pedataha. Pitrapudradhyatmana Pedataha. Swapne Jagrati Vaya Esha Purushaha. Swapne Jagrati Vaya Esha Purushaha. Maya Paripramitaha. Maya Paripramitaha. Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Namaidam. Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Namaidam. Shri Dakshina Murtaye. Shri Dakshina Murtaye. Purusha, a person, a conscious being, us. Purusha is the conscious being. So, a person in the waking state or in the dream state, either one is fine, waking state or dream state, a person being completely deluded by Maya. Paribrahmitaha, person, because of being really the person who had been completely deluded by Maya in the waking state or the dream state, Vishwam Pashyati experiences, sees this universe, the Vishwa, this universe, in terms of cause-effect relationship, in terms of duality, sees the creation in terms of duality, sees reality. You experience a person, you know, in the waking state or the dream state, experiences this world from the standpoint of duality, either in terms of cause and effect, right? Karya karana, cause effect, this causes that, but then of course that causes this, and then that causes that. And the cause, the whole cause effect thing is a huge can of worms, as is everything within Maya, everything within duality. Cause effect is everything goes into an infinite regress, but nevertheless, within duality, we do experience cause-effect relationships. It's just you can never get to the end of it. You can't ever get to the first cause within duality. There's not a first moment within duality. You know, there's not a first object within duality. So it's a kind of a chicken and egg type of situation. What comes first and how can you get to the first one? So first causes are difficult within duality. And nevertheless, we experience and we require also knowledge of cause-effect relationships just to function. But so we experience this world in terms of cause-effect. We also experience it in terms of power relationships like master and servant, employer-employee. That's the Swaswami Sambandataha. So in terms of these unequal relationships, you know, where one person is responsible or has a power relationship over another person. So that's also, even parents and children, right? They have another one for that. But anyway, power relationships we experience. Also, we experience the duality in terms of the Shisha and Acharya. Shisha and Acharya is teacher-student. it can be teacher-student in terms of your high school teachers or your college teachers or your mentors, but also in the guru-sisha relationship. You know, this is my teacher. This teacher is giving me self-knowledge. My teacher is liberated and needs to give me knowledge so that I can also be liberated. So this guru-sisha relationship also is something that we experience within duality. Then also the Pitra-Putra means father-son. Father-son, mother-daughter, mother-son. This familial relationships that we experience within duality. So these things are not saying anything new. I mean, this is what we experience in the world, whether it be in the waking state or the dream state, because I am an individual within this world, and I experience this world through my sense organs in my mind. It's just very cut and dried. This body, mind, sense organs is a creation, is a product of this creation. Your body is made of food, you know, and food is made of vegetables, you know, and other things. In the end, it's made of vegetables, right? And so all of these things, the whole body complex is really, you know, part of the material of this creation. And we can say even the mind also on a subtle level, if we're using more of a Vedantic schema of things, the mind also is part of Hiranyagarbha, is part of the total subtle mind. So all of these things, everything that makes you an individual, it is existent and a product of the whole. You are a part to the whole. And your whole being, in terms of your body, mind, sense complex, is meant to respond to and engage with the whole. That's what this upadhi does. Upadhi means this conditioning agent that you have a total identification with as yourself. Now, there is a reason that there is this maya, paribrahmitaha. Brahma means this delusion, you know. Pari means it's total, all the way around. It's an illusion or a delusion that totally encircles you like a fish in water. And what is the cause for this delusion? Maya, which is the very material of this creation, your creation itself. And so now, we have to look at what the situation is here. So when they say the human being, this person, is totally deluded by Maya in the waking state and the dream state, right? We have to kind of analyze what that situation is. What is it that causes that delusion? So this is what we're going to be talking about. I'm going to be using a few other examples and we'll keep getting back to this, okay? We always have our meadow example, so I'll be using that one. Meadow example is, you know, has its value. Dream example has its value too. But the situation is this. You experience yourself as a conscious being within this creation. But you don't experience the space surrounding you as a conscious being. Right? So if I say I am a conscious being, it ends at my skin. And if I look at you and I say you are a conscious being also, there's a lot of unconscious space between us. Right? And so, therefore, there's no way of my saying, from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, that I am you. I can't say I am you, right? Because I am a conscious being, and then there's this non-consciousness, and then there's conscious pockets around me. So I can't possibly be you, right? Because there's space between us, and space is not conscious. It's not like my sense of self extends to include you. The sense of self stops right here. And so, because of that, I take myself to be an individual entity within this creation. And this creation itself doesn't appear to me to be conscious. I don't even say I'm a conscious being within a conscious creation. Because that's not my experience. My experience is that I'm a conscious being within an inert creation which enjoys other conscious beings within it. Mm. You know. And then we'll even say, and if there is a God, You know, if we, for those of us who believe in God, if there's a God, God also is a conscious being, right, who is in heaven. So initially, this is quite literal. There's a conscious being in heaven who is the... It may not be literal for you, but for many people it is literal, including my mom. Very literal. Okay? That there's a conscious being in heaven who is the creator of this world, that type of thing. So we're conscious beings. We're all conscious beings, and God is more of a super conscious being who created this world. You know, and from a Christian standpoint, we say created this world out of nothing. But that's more. It's not just a Christian standpoint. It's a dual standpoint. It's within duality that this dual standpoint is pervasive all over the world, not just in the West. Even in India, they have Dvaita. Even Sankhya has a certain type of Dvaita. It's a little bit different. So anyway, what I'm saying is that if we are viewing our experience from within the creation, as we do, and we didn't choose it this way, it's just the way it is. You know, it's not like you were at one point envisioning the creation from outside of the creation, and now you've decided to jump into it. It's that this jivatvam, this being an individual within the creation, is something which is beginningless. When were you not an individual within the creation? If we accept reincarnation and beginningless birth, after birth, after birth, after birth, there's no time when you were not an individual within the creation. And even if you don't accept the reincarnation, there's still no time when you were that you were not an individual within the creation, from the standpoint of Visuddhi. That's the situation. And so that's why this Brahma is putty. Because their putty means it, that you're attacked from all sides on it, like a fish in water. Because there's no situation that you can be in within time and space which is going to give you a different experience than that. Because of the means of knowledge you have available, you have your sense organs and your mind, right? Your sense organs and your mind, which enliven the physical body and the world. And so everything that I experience is going to be in light of that mind and sense organs. Right? So now, that being the case, if I say I am a conscious being, I'm talking about me, the body-mind complex, as a conscious being. I am a conscious being. I'm never saying I am a conscious being that is other than the body-mind complex. You might say like this, I believe I am a conscious being which is a soul that will transmigrate or travel to heaven and hell within the time-space reality. But that's still, I am a conscious being in the shape of a soul or in the shape of a subtle body, right, that travels within duality. As long as I'm traveling within time and space, traveling within duality, I am enmeshed totally in Maya, enmeshed totally within time and space, within duality, within the creation. So now, this is our little problem. So now, think, this being the situation, say if we just focus on the mind for now, and if you say, I am a conscious being, you might as well say, you know, my mind is conscious. I'm a conscious being. Or you could even say like this, I'm a conscious being because I have a mind. Now, why would I say that? I say that because the mind, as long as it is here, is never without consciousness. You know, as long as, if my mind is, let me put it this way, if my mind is in the waking state and dream state, we'll just take, don't take coma or anything like that for now. Okay? In the waking state or in the dream state, the mind is here, it enjoys consciousness. Imagine having a mind, your mind is here, but there's no consciousness. I'm not talking about deep sleep or coma or anything like that. I'm saying now, here we are. You're like, your mind is present. Now, it could be daydreaming. It could be thinking about something else. It could be doing whatever it's doing. But whatever it's doing, it is enjoying consciousness as it does it. Right? And you can't remove the consciousness from it. Right? And so the mind and consciousness go together. So how am I, you know, if the mind and consciousness for me go together, how then, you know, am I not going to be experiencing, how am I ever going to be free of being within this creation? So how am I ever not going to be an object, a being within the creation? It's not possible. So this is the starting place, you know. This is where people start from. Like even in the Upanishads, you know, this student will always go to the teacher, you know, and pray Bhagawan, you know, who am I really? Is there something about me that is free of this duality? Is there anything about me that is free of dharma adharma, that is not subject to death? You know, what if you were to ask that question? Is there anything about you that is not subject to death? Well, everything you know is subject to change, you know. Every experience that you have is subject to change. You'll never escape that one. But when Nachiketas asked this question, he's an Indian, he's a Hindu, he asked this question in the Katha Upanishad, he asked Lord Yama. And now he's already died and he's gone to heaven. He's still asking Lord Yama the same question. He's died, he's gone to heaven. And so here he is now. You know, Lord Yama had gone off and wandered around for a few days, and he came back late, and Nachiketas had been waiting for him for 3 days, and he was a great, you know, a brahmana, and that should never have happened. Lord Yama just kind of didn't pay attention to him properly for 3 days. So he felt terrible about that, and it was an adharma, and he said, I will give you 3 boons to make up for this, you know? And so Nachiketas took those 3 boons. His first boon was something about, you know, it hurt my father very much that I died in the way that I died. You know, please make him happy and know that I'm still, that, and so that he can see me again and know that I'm fine, something like that. And then he asked for another boon about being able to go to Swargaloka in heaven and all of these things. So, yes, got all of them, got those two. We had one more left. And the one more left was something like, I would like to know myself. I would like to know the truth. Is there something beyond you? And you're the one that would know. Is there, because it's Lord Yama, it's Lord Death. Is there anyone, you know, anything about me that survives death? Now, I think it's the funniest question, because here he is talking to Lord Death. He's already survived death. Right? So we're not talking about the sukshma sharira. We're not talking about the subtle body. Is there anything about me that is free from this transmigratory experience of birth, death, birth, death, birth, death? That's what he's asking. Is there anything about me that is free? Only you can tell me, you know? Only you can tell me this. The reason, you know, he says like this, you are the very best person to tell me this because you're the Lord of Death, you know? But why does he need Lord Yama? You know, why does he need Lord Yama to tell? The reason is because you, based upon your means of knowledge, have no way, you have no means of knowledge to answer that question. The means of knowledge you have at your disposal as a human being can only give you knowledge of what is within duality. You know, even in terms of your states of mind, mental experiences, emotional experiences, astral traveling, you know, meditative states, experiences that are born of sense perception, inferences, all of the experiences you have are experiences within duality. Those experiences are subject to change. Even meditative states, those are states of mind. I'm talking about meditative states. I'm not talking about the self that illumines the meditative state. That's different. But meditative states themselves come and go. Otherwise, you would say, oh, you know, I reached this meditative state and I'm still there. Even though, you know, I'm talking and doing this and doing that. I went into Nirvikalpa Samadhi and I never came out, though I'm talking to you now. You know, it's just not the case. It is not the case. Meditative states come and go. All states come and go. All mental states come and go. All perceptions come and go, all experiences come and go. There's simply no exception, you know? And so, and there's no exception because you don't have means of knowledge available to you, you know, that have a sphere outside of duality. Even the mind itself, you know, its sphere is within duality. Now, so, what means of knowledge are you going to use, you know, to answer, as Nachiketa is going to use to answer his question, you know? It's a problem. It's a real problem. And that's why here Shankara is saying that a person, you know, in the waking state and in the dream, he chooses these two states because these two states involve the dual world which I find myself placed in. There is a total delusion brought about by Maya. By Maya means your body, mind, sense organs, and the creation itself are a product of the Maya, are a product of the dual world, and can't get out of it. If you were to get out of it, where are you going to go? Where can something which is within duality go? It can't go into non-duality. You're going to drag your body into non-duality? Well, there's no room for the body there. No. If we have such a thing as non-duality versus duality, that's also a misnomer. You can't have a duality if there's such a thing as non-duality. You see that? Mm. But non-duality on this side, and duality on this side. Right? That's dual. That's dual. Okay. So now, the situation is, how to get out of this? And so the Upanishads are always a dialogue between a student who goes to their teacher to ask, is there a way out? And the Upanishad itself views itself as a means of knowledge in order to hold up a mirror to that reality to get you out of this, get you out of this problem. Now, the only way any type of teaching, whether it be an Upanishad or anything else, can get you out of this problem of a recognition of something that is free from duality, that is not subject to duality, is if there is such a thing. You can't pretend here. It's either there as a reality, or it's not. So if it's there, and there's a means of knowledge, then you can recognize it. Mm. If it's not there, you can't recognize it, because it's not there. You certainly can't create it. You can't create the non-dual, because creation involves duality. So either reality is non-dual, or it's not. If it is non-dual, your problem is one of ignorance. If it's not non-dual, then there's no such thing as non-dual, so you don't have to worry about it. You just have to figure out a way to manage in this dual world. Right? But if non-duality is the reality, then your problem is not one that you can do something about, because it already is the reality. Your problem is one of ignorance and the removal of that ignorance. Now, say there is no such thing as non-duality, then it's all, you can have somebody teaching you until they're blue in the face and you're also dead on the ground and nothing will happen. You won't see anything because there's nothing there to be seen. But if the reality is non-dual and there's a teaching methodology to make you see that, then you'll see it. That's the end of it. That's what it is. Now, so in this verse, all of these verses end with tasmai, right? Shri Guru Murtiye Nama Idam, Shri Dakshina Murtiye. Each one of these verses ends with this line. Salutations to the Lord in the form of Dakshina Murti. Dakshina Murti is considered Lord Shiva in the form of the first teacher, right? So the teacher of self-knowledge. So that's Dakshina Murti. And to the Dakshinamurti, who is Sri Guru Murtiye, who is in the form of my teacher. So Dakshinamurti, the Lord is in the whole creation, in the whole tradition. The Guru Sisha relationship starts with Dakshinamurti. It starts with the Lord and is something that goes down from beginningless time all the way through. As long as the creation is there, this Guru Sisha relationship is said to maintain itself. And that Guru-Sisha relationship is really viewed as, well, say, this is a little bit of an aside, but say if you have your, like, mother-daughter, 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 It goes all of the way through. As long as there's human beings, there's going to be this familial relationship, this familial procreation. You know? Like that, they say, this knowledge, this means of knowledge that goes guru sisha, guru sisha, guru sisha, is something that is maintained as long as the creation is. It's viewed as an actual pramana that you are not wearing. Right? In other words, as a human being, you're wearing, you have as part of the human body, your eyes and your ears and your sense perception, and then through your, all your sense perception, you can make inferences and presumptions. But all of these means of knowledge you have available to you, every single one of them is limited. It has a sphere of, it's limited to what is going on within the dual world. That's what all of our means of knowledge are. The Upanishad, which is meant to be taught by a teacher, right? So that's the guru. The guru is not just a person. The guru is not just somebody blabbing. The guru is somebody who is actually through whom this knowledge is flowing. And it's not the guru's knowledge. You know, the guru isn't somebody who's the teacher in this tradition. It's not somebody who's just decided, well, I think I know this is how it is. I think this is how it is, and so let me share my philosophy with you. That's not a guru in this tradition, you know. The guru is the one who is holding that Upanishadic tradition and passing it on, just as the teacher received it, so the teacher gives it to you. There's a whole teaching tradition involved. And so whatever the teacher is saying is something that the teacher himself or herself had also been taught. When I first went to India with Swamiji, studying with Swamiji, before we learned Sanskrit, you know, we were all there, like for the first 6 months we were just learning Sanskrit, and Swamiji was using a lot of Sanskrit terminology and kind of introducing us to all of that. But what he really would say so many times to us is that you need the Sanskrit. And this isn't a sell job for you at all, that's not the point. I want you to understand. I want you to have the Sanskrit, and I want you to read through all of these shlokas and commentaries and the commentaries on the shlokas, so you can see that everything that I'm teaching, that this isn't, you know, Swamiji, this isn't Swami Dayananda, that this is a sampradaya. And I didn't really think much about it because I thought, oh, Swamiji, I know that what you're saying, that's what the Upanishads are saying it because you told us that, you know. And so I thought, oh, that's not necessary. But when I saw that, when I saw that every single thing that he says is there, it's there in the Upanishads, in the commentaries, it's there in the Sanskrit, there's no denying it, that whole sampradaya is there. And that sampradaya means that teaching methodology. And that teaching methodology points something out to you. It points out yourself to you. Yourself that is there to be seen. And so here in this verse, it says, salutations to my teacher, to Lord Dakshinamurti, who's now in the form of the teacher. The one, that one, that Purusha. So salutations to him. Who... Now talking to him means now to that Atma, the self, which is the truth of Dakshinamurti and the truth of the Guru. That self who is completely deluded by Maya in the waking state and the dream state and sees this universe as being totally enmeshed in duality. So, this is the thing. The prayer is to the salutations, the namaskar, is to Dakshinamurti. So it's not going to be the Dakshinamurti who is sitting there teaching. It's to Dakshinamurti, who is the Purusha, who is the self, the person, who is you, right? That Dakshinamurti, the self of Dakshinamurti, is you. And you are the one who is Dakshinamurti, who sees, right, in the waking state and the dream state, being totally deluded by Maya, experiences this world as dual, in terms of cause and effect, in terms of teacher-student, in terms of employer-employee, master-servant, in terms of the whole familial line, you see yourself, right, as this person. And why do you, who you are, see yourself as, you know, as this person within duality, in the waking state and the dream state? Why do you see yourself like that? Because of this delusion brought about by Maya. So you, so it goes like this, it'll go like this in the end. The teacher, who is also, here in this case, well, the teacher who is Dakshinamurti and now in the form of my teacher, so we'll just keep with Dakshinamurti, okay? Dakshinamurti, remember in the opening prayer, is teaching all of these old sadhus. You know, all of these elders, you know, because the Lord is, the self is ever young, right? For the self, there's no age. So he's teaching all of these old elders, these elder sannyasis, and he's teaching this Chin Mudra. What is Dakshinamurti teaching them? He's teaching that the self that you are, right? The self that you are is the self which, in fact, is untouched by this cause and effect, by this Brahma. I'll get into that in a minute. But what he's saying is the self that, and then it works out like this. The self that I am, right, is the self that you are. This self that I am is the self that you are. The difference between us is that you are deluded by Maya and I'm not. That's the only difference. Now, I'll just say, you are deluded by Maya and I'm not. This is the teacher-student. What does it mean? It means... Okay, now I'm going to go to this other example because I like this one. If the sun is shining, you know, on some rain clouds, say some dark rain clouds, the sun is illumining the dark rain clouds, right? You're looking at those dark rain clouds. You are able to see them, right? You're looking up at them. There's these dark rain clouds. You are able to see them. You're able to see them because the sun is there. In other words, because the sun is there, there's light. And because there's light, the rain clouds are illumined, right? And so, but in this situation, even though the rain clouds are illumined because there is light, what you're experiencing is the rain clouds. But you're experiencing the rain clouds because the light is there. Do you see that? Like if it was at night, the rain clouds would be there, but you wouldn't be able to see them because no sun, right? And so now, in the situation with the rain clouds, there is what we call a total adhyasa, like a superimposition, between the light, right? The light and the cloud. We don't think about it like that. We just recognize that we see the cloud. Right? We see the cloud. We don't acknowledge the light because of which we see the cloud. See that? So the cloud and the light are as though one. The light is totally superseded, in fact, by the cloud. Right? Now, that's an obvious experience for someone who's standing on the earth, right? Someone who's standing on the earth is looking at the clouds, right? Looking at the clouds, able to see the clouds, but they're not experiencing the clouds from the standpoint of the sun, right? And so for such a person, there's a total adhyasa, there's a total superimposition between the light and the clouds, right? And in the experience of that superimposition, there is no experience of the sun from your standpoint. You're not experiencing the sun because the clouds are blocking the sun. But the clouds, in fact, are seen only because of the sun. So here, this is a little tricky, but you have to have a flexible mind for it. But I want you to be able to play with this one.
Stretch.
I'll stretch because I'm jumping from different, looking around from different aspects. The situation that we have, and that we even know we have, but don't acknowledge that we have, it's experience, just an experiential fact, is that, say if we look at the clouds as our mind, yeah, the clouds are our mind. Our mind's in a bad mood. The clouds are a bad mood, right? I'm experiencing the bad mood. I'm experiencing the rain cloud, right? But I'm experiencing the rain cloud of my bad mood because I'm aware of it. If I weren't there aware of the bad mood, right, I wouldn't experience it. So the bad mood is experienced in consciousness. But I don't think like that. Even though that's a fact, that I'm aware of the bad mood and I can go on and on describing it to you, you know, what it's like, how it feels, you know, I'm totally aware of it. That fact is lost to me. And so like the light illumining the cloud, the conscious being illumining the rain cloud is lost. It's not thought about at all. That's the total Brahma, you know. I am present, illuminating. I'm the presence. I'm the conscious me that is there present, changelessly, in fact, to every experience I have, whether it be a rain cloud, you know, a bad mood, or a neutral mood, or a good mood, you know, or whether my body is tired or sick, you know, or healthy, or whether I'm perceiving this room or I'm taking a walk in the park, whatever experiences that I'm having are there because I'm aware of them. And so the person who's aware is the constant. It never changes. The objects of awareness change continually. In fact, the objects of awareness never don't change. But all of these objects that are changing, some for the good, some for the bad, some pleasurable, some painful, all of those changing objects, all of those changing experiences are taking place in me who illumines them, in the conscious being that illumines them. And that one is never changing. Now, that's the problem. I am never changing, and so I'm taken for granted. I'm like the air. I'm like the water. You know, it's like a fish going through water. It never thinks about the water because it's never without the water. You never think about yourself because you're never without yourself. You are like the fabric. You're the constant. The constant that is there in the bad mood and in the good mood. The constant's there that's in the happy experience, the negative experience. It's a constant. It never changes. And so therefore it becomes invisible. Right? And so what has to happen, and this is what causes the delusion, because you are invisible, you're the consciousness that is never not there. And so because you're never not there, there's nothing need differentiate you from all of these experiences because you're in all of them, you know? So that being so, it's just like the rain cloud and light being one and the same thing. You and your body, mind, sense organs, complex, you are one and the same thing. You know? There's no differentiation. Now, there is a differentiation. So between the conscious me and the body, mind, sense organs, there's no differentiation because I'm always present to it. As long as I'm awake, I'm there. And from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs. And now I can differentiate myself so this is the start of the grand delusion. But because I can differentiate, I don't need to differentiate myself, and I don't differentiate myself from the body, mind, sense organs, because the body, mind, sense organs, as long as they're awake, are always reflecting me, or in the dream state, as long as I have a body, mind, sense organs, it's enjoying me, it's enjoying consciousness. And so there, since that's the constant, you know, what I'm concerned about is what changes, not what is the constant. And then I can differentiate the conscious being, it stops at the skin, because of another illusion, that because I take my body, mind, sense organs to be one thing, I now differentiate this world outside of the body, mind, sense organs as the known and me as the knower. What that means, if you guys are still with me, I don't know, try. This world outside of the body is in consciousness too, because it is known. It's lit up. I know it, right? But this is known, and I'm the knower. That's what, so I become the knower, this becomes the known. But in reality, that's part of the delusion. I'm now an object looking at you through my sense organ, so I become the knower and you're the known. But in fact, what is known is lit up, as well as everything that makes the knower is lit up. So let me say it in a different way. This is all known, so all is lit up by consciousness. This body also is known. It is lit up by consciousness. The sense organs are known. They're lit up by consciousness. The mind is known. It's lit up by consciousness. Consciousness is known because it's lit up by consciousness, because it is consciousness. And so, in reality, there is only consciousness here. Absolutely everything I experience is in consciousness. Another problem. It just extends the problem. Consciousness is the common denominator. There's no place where consciousness is not, whether it be viewed in terms of the subject or viewed in terms of the object. This is known. It's in consciousness. I am the knower. I'm in consciousness. Well, I'm the knower? Well, wait a minute. I'm the knower, but the body is known, so I'm the knower and the known. In reference to this body, right? I'm the knower, I'm the known. Sense organs know the body, right? So they become the knower of the body. The mind knows the sense organs, so the mind becomes the knower of the sense organs. The sense organs are the knower of the body, but they're also the knower of all of this. In fact, everything that makes me the knower is also the known. You see how this is kind of goes like this? So now you have to slow down everything and say, well, wait a minute. The knower, what is ultimately the knower, it's not going to be your sense organs because they're known, right? It's not going to be the mind because it's known. Well, then what is it going to be? Is it going to be consciousness? It's another problem. These are all big problems. That's why the illusion is so big, so complete. You can say, the knower must be consciousness then. But the knower can't be consciousness without, the consciousness can't be a knower without your sense organs. So look at, I say consciousness in the end, I am the conscious being, I am the knower. Are you a knower? What if I get rid of your sense organs? What if I get rid of your eyes? You're not a knower of color now. You're still consciousness, but you're not your conscious being, but you're not a knower of color. Get rid of your ears. You're a conscious being, but you can't hear. Get rid of all five sense organs. You have no perception of the world, including this body, but you're a conscious being. But you're not a knower through your sense organs. What about the mind? The mind is known. Every thought of it is known, every mood is known, every emotion is known. Are you a knower without the mind? The mind, you can say, is a knower. You know, it, because of the mind, I'm aware of my sense organs, that type of thing. But you illumine your mind. So if you get rid of the mind that's known, are you a knower? Is consciousness a knower? You see? What's it using to know? It's just consciousness. So this is another big problem. It's not really a problem, but it can be. It's a problem from within duality because you think that you are a knower. And you are a knower from the standpoint of your sense organs and your mind. But consciousness illumines your mind. And consciousness by itself is not a knower. What's it knowing and with what? It's just consciousness. If consciousness is a knower, then I can't be you because I know different things than you do. right? I have different experiences than you do. So there's no identity. I can't be. How can I be Ishwar? And Ishwar knows the whole thing. But Ishwar is the one, the whole infinite creation is known. It's manifest knowledge. I don't have that knowledge. So then if I say, you know, you are Ishwar, how could that be possible if your being is a knower? And so to know yourself, see the whole, the conscious being that you are, which is consciousness, it is light, it is because of which everything is known. Because of which everything is known. The mind is known. Say every thought is known. A thought, a vritti, a thought is known. If you get rid of the thought, then what? There's just the knownness of consciousness. You put the thought there, then the thought is known. Take away the thought, and then what's there? Known, consciousness. And so, when in the end, what is the truth of all experience is only consciousness, conscious being, which lights up every experience. There's nothing away from that experience. Yeah. And it itself is not doing anything. Then it's very tough, you know, impossible in fact, for you as a jiva to understand the reality of yourself. Do you see what I'm saying? Because the reality of yourself is both the subject and the object, you know. Now let's go to the meadow. Let's go to the meadow for a minute. If you imagine a meadow, right? If you imagine a meadow, and you put beings in the meadow, are all talking to each other, are all friends, they're all camping out in the meadow, having a picnic in the meadow, right? And say there are a group of mumukshus there in the meadow. They all want to know the truth, what's going on. What are they going to do? What can they do? You know, they can start, you know, taking the grass apart or bringing in microscopes and telescopes and math and all kinds of things to try to understand what the nature of the truth of the meadow is. But the meadow is infinitely divisible. Maya is infinitely divisible. You'll never get to the bottom of it. And you can never get beyond it because you can't get to the moment prior to the manifestation of the meadow. Right? And all of your means of knowledge are just going to support the duality of the meadow and run up against the wall of infinite regress. So you're kind of helpless. But there has to be a way out in a compassionate creation. This is Upanishad talk now. There has to be a way out in a compassionate creation. And the reason there even is a way out is because your being is the truth of the meadow. Right? The conscious being, which is not a knower. Just think consciousness, the conscious being that is you, plus this Maya which projects the meadow. There is nothing in that meadow that is other than that conscious being. Because anything you try to find in the meadow is an infinite regress. You can't find any object there. The only thing that is always left in any analysis is just the Satchit, conscious being. That's all that is there. And so you need a guru who will come and make you recognize yourself, the constant that is not the constant, your being, which is constant, which is not limited to this body, mind, sense organs. The consciousness which lights up the body, mind, sense organs, the space, the air, the fire, the earth, the whole thing, you know, is nothing but the very Satchit that you are. And the Satchit, the conscious being that you are, is not something that can be objectified because it's already there. You know, that's why when we were doing Rudram, this Ashave, the one consciousness is that which pervades everything, and the other word, Shibhya, I think they used, it's already there when, say, you send your mind to the moon. This is in the Katha, I think. If I send my mind to the moon, you know, through my eyes, it gets there really fast. But consciousness is already there. There's nothing here. In other words, they use that as an example. There's nothing here that is away from or other than consciousness. And that, in fact, is your experience in the sense this way. Just if you just take this room is in consciousness. It is known, right? Which it is. Everything in the room is known through your sense organs. But your body is also known. Your sense organs are known. The mind is known. Consciousness is known. There's nothing here but known. Known is a synonym for consciousness. You try if you analyze your experience. Like if I say the painting is known, this space, you can do it with the wall. I'm saying the painting is known, the space is known between the wall and this body is known, my sense organs are known, my thoughts are known, the I notion even is known, the self is known. There is nothing that everything is known. You know? But now the only thing is, so there's nothing out of the experience of known, but everything that's in the experience of known, it is known, it is known, it is known, you know, can change and go away. Right? Like you can walk out of the room and then you're not known through my sense perception. So everything that is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. If it can be objectified, it's known, but it can leave. And it does leave. In fact, this moment is much different than the last moment. I mean, so many changes have gone on. That's gone, but this is known. So now, if you think of it like that, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. Any knownness, anything known that's objectified, comes and goes. What doesn't come and go is it is known. It is known is a synonym for consciousness. Yeah. And that consciousness is the thing that is the very being of this creation. It is myself. It is the very being of this creation. But because of this Dehatma Buddhi, you know, existing at this body, mind, sense organs existing within this creation, I don't notice myself. I don't notice that. Yeah. But if I do notice it, then I will never not notice it again. Once I notice it, once I notice, I will not notice it again. There can still be all kinds of complexes and problems and everything that goes on in the mind. The mind has to settle down. But if you notice, if you do that viveka, if once you see it, you know, you don't change. Your mind changes, your emotions change, your perceptions change, your experiences change, but you don't. The self of those experiences never changes. And then the question is, what is the nature of you, the one that doesn't change? What are you like? If I say, I'm Satchit, I'm consciousness, I'm existent consciousness. How boring. It's not enough. That's why they say Satchit Ananda. Satchit Ananda, because in fact the Satchit that you are is the most dear to you. There's nothing more dear to you than that. It is the beloved. It's what all the mystics talk about as the beloved. Why do they talk about Satchit as the beloved? It's Ananda. We're not talking about the ananda or love as an experience that comes and goes. Those are bliss experiences or love experiences. That's different. Those are mental experiences, you know, like when the clouds go away, you can see the sun. For the sun, the clouds don't affect the sun, right? They affect you looking at the sun. They don't affect the sun. So the ananda that we're talking about is not an ananda that comes and goes or is affected by mental states. It's the very one that is present to the mental states. What is that one like? You know, it's a good experiment to do is when you're having an unwanted mental state. You know? When you're having an unwanted mental state, is just to sit with that state for a moment. Just to relax. Okay, this is sadness, or whatever it may be, this is sadness, you know? Then just allow yourself to be aware of your presence in that sadness. Even those words make a difference. Just notice your presence in the sadness. And let your presence hold the sadness. As soon as you start to do that, you're differentiating you from the changing mental state. And start getting used to yourself. You know? Then when there's another mental state of whatever kind it is, emotion or what, then you just relax. You be with that mental state. And then you notice yourself, you know, the one who's there, present to that mental state. And notice what you are like. And let yourself hold that mental state. You know, we do these meditations where I talk about inner friend and all that. The inner friend is where your buddhi, your mind, identifies itself, finds that friendship, that friend in yourself, you know, the buddhi does. But actually what the buddhi is relying on for that wholeness or that friend is the self. Yeah. So the very swarupa, the very nature of that self that is present to the unfortunate mental states, you know, has the nature of an inner friend, or the nature of the beloved, or the nature of God, when you think of God as one who, if you have a positive relationship with God, you know, one who can hold, the one who is whole and complete, you start recognizing that, the constancy of that wholeness, of the sacred, of that which is whole, that which is sacred, that which is the divine, that which is whatever words you want to use. If we use words like whole and sacred and divine, the problem with those words is they tend to take you away from the very simple simplicity of your own being. You know? But the simplicity of your own being, you should get in touch with that and then say, why do they call that the beloved? Or why do they call this simplicity, wholeness of my own being, the divine? That's a very grounding experience. So otherwise these are big words, and they take us on big trips. But if you take these big words, even the word like ananda, and you say like this, why do they say that the simple, my simple presence is ananda? Why is it called ananda? We usually don't do it like that. We usually think, ananda, where is it? You know, but you're looking for some highfalutin experiential state, like a bliss state or some powerful meditative experience. But that's not it. You know why? Because they go. They can be wonderful, wonderful bliss states, wonderful divine, you know, profound states and experiences. Those are all there. They all exist within in Maya. But those are not the self. Because the self is there in total, fully, in every state. It doesn't require a bliss state. It doesn't require a sad state either. It doesn't require any state. It's the self of all states. So you need to differentiate the self of all states. One that is always, always there, fully, not partially. Then we think like this, well, I'm always there, but, you know, when the clouds are there, I'm lost in the clouds. I'm not able to be recognized amidst the clouds, you know. And so I need to remove the clouds so that I can see myself. That's not right. It's like, from the standpoint of the sun would say, it's on, the clouds are there. I'm illuminating them. Nothing's happening to me. You have to be able to say that. You have to be able to say, yes, this state is there, this mental state is there, it's a painful mental state. That's true. It's not like we're saying the mental state or whatever it is, the emotion is not painful. Yeah, it's painful. It's a sorrowful state, or it's a hurt state, or it's whatever state it is. But I am there illuminating it, and I'm not covered by it. That's the fact. That's what needs to be recognized. Otherwise, you're on a trip. You're on a trip because what you're saying is, I need to have a state. I need to have a particular type of state in order to be present to myself. And that isn't true. You're not a state. You're the one who's there present to all states. That's the difference. It's like you're the sun illumining the rain clouds or the puffy clouds or the lack of clouds. And you're not saying, the sun isn't saying, oh, I'm getting really, really darkened by these clouds. The sun is not getting darkened by the clouds. And you're not getting darkened by your mental states. The mental states are dark. But you're the one that illumines them. That's the viveka. You know? That's the viveka. It's not anything less than that. And that's what's not understood, which means that we're still within this paribrahma, this total delusion brought about by Maya, because we're still a jiva, you know, looking around this creation, looking around at our mind and our various mental states, trying to get ones that are better than other ones. Which I don't have any objection to that, but if you think that you are the mental state, that's the problem. See what I mean? That you, that through Dharma and through meditative practices, or especially through Dharma, through Karma Yoga, and all of these things and knowledge, the mind does settle down, and that's nice. I would rather have a nice, calm mind than an agitated, painful one. No problem. I would rather have a healthy body, too, than a sick one. What's wrong with that? Nobody's going to say, I want to have a miserable mind and an unhealthy body just so that I can recognize that I'm free of all of it. No, I'll take the healthy body and I'll take the calm mind. But that is not moksha. That's just taking care of yourself within the dual world. That's fine. There's nothing wrong in it. It's when you say, you know, I'll do asanas for 3 hours a day and meditate for five and do this and, you know, create these relatively stable states and hang on to them for as long as I can. That's duality. That has nothing to do with you. You need to recognize yourself as the one who's there, period, no matter what the state. That's the truth, you know. And then to see what is your relationship to all of this, you know. You recognize I'm both the subject and the object, just like in the meadow. If you're a character in the meadow, right, you recognize that I am the conscious being, that the subject, I'm identified with the character in the meadow. That character, the jnani character, the one who has knowledge, recognizes, you know, I am the self. I am the self of the subject, and I'm the self of the object. I'm the self of this body, and I'm the self of that body. I'm the self of this body, and I'm the self of this table. That, in fact, I'm the self of the whole. That's the viveka. You know, a good meditation to do around all of this also, because that what gets a lot in the way of this is not just the dehatma buddhi, but this idea of knowership, that I'm a knower. A really beautiful meditation, maybe if you remind me, I'll try to do it next week, is to just sit with yourself, quieten down everything, watch, do japa or something, and watch the mind, the thoughts go by. And then just see, just recognize your own presence. Are you a knower? Are you knowing anything? Are you doing anything? And you'll see, you're not doing anything at all. You just are. You just simply are you. You are being. You are being, and you are consciousness. You are a conscious being. You're not doing anything. You can notice it right now. You know, that you just simply are. And nothing touches you, nothing changes you. It doesn't make any difference what the thoughts or the moods or the emotions are. And that what is the nature of that me is ananda. And that's not an ananda to look for. You have to say, ananda, why is that the nature of me? Yeah, there's nothing more than that. There's nothing more meaningful than my own presence. That's a big discovery, and it's very obvious once you get it. So, okay, that was a little journey. Let's stop. Om Purnamidah Purnamidam
Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Could we say, I mean, I get why we don't say that the self is a knower.
Oh, good.
Because the word knowing implies a duality just in that verb, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So could we say that the self is an illuminer? Could we say that the self is doing anything with a verb? Like, do you know what I mean?
It's not a verb, but yeah, I do know what you mean. Like, if you say, once you say it's illumining or it's just, because it is consciousness, everything in its scope enjoys consciousness or is illumined, is known. That's why sometimes I use the word known. It is known. And then so Maya, which has no substance at all other than the self, if the self experience is one of is known as a synonym for consciousness, then whatever Maya is there, that is known. See what I mean? So,
I guess, so then the other question I have is, it feels like there should be a different word other than known, because when I hear that word, at least in English, that word, there's no way to get outside of duality with that word. So to use that word in relationship to the self,
yeah,
feels strange.
It
feels
is.
Like there should be, like, am I right in feeling like there should,
yeah,
be a different word?
We can use another word. I like to use that word only because, and Swamiji doesn't use it as much as I do. Mm-hmm. I like to use it because I think that the word known is the word that we use in duality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. Everything is known. But that word known can be taken all the way to the self, because consciousness is known in the self, that it, in the sense that not known as an object, but it is self-evident. And so if you take knownness all the way to consciousness, then there's no knower. There's only known.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with you, the word is problematic, but I still try to play with it to make this thing known. Now say you use... to make that understood that there really, in your, even in your experience, there is no knower, because everything is known, even the self. So it's as though knownness radiates instead of knowership, right? So from this way all the way in. Now, if illumining, because of the sun example, illumining can be good. It's a helpful word, because when we think of the sun illumining the earth, it's not a verb. It's a intransitive verb, in the sense that that's, you know,
yeah,
between transitive and intransitive.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an intransitive verb, means that's what its nature is.
Mm. And intransitive verb.
It doesn't take an object. Intransitive verb doesn't take an object. It's only if you're a grammarian. Intransitive verb.
That went right over my head.
It doesn't take an object. You know, and so that's just its nature. It's not doing it. And so it's not saying, oh, let me illumine this or let me illumine that or make any type of choice. It's just its nature. So consciousness is like that. It's just consciousness. It's its nature. And so it's not performing an act. It's simply being consciousness. And so anything that is within its wake, which we can talk about Maya like that, that eventually that type of dual talk will go away. But if we talk about Maya like that, then like a mind, for instance, when the vritti, thought modification, is there, it will be known, because it's not away from consciousness. It will be illumined, you can say, because consciousness is luminous,
hmm,
as consciousness.
What about the word sakshi?
Now the word sakshi, when we use that word, sakshi translates as the witness. That's what it means, the witness. We use the word sakshi in the drik drisha viveka, the seer-seeing differentiation, in order to differentiate, especially the mind, from consciousness. So we say, the mind is known, consciousness is the sakshi. Okay? But that's, that sakshi, this the sakshi, is only lasts until you get to the recognition of the mind is known and differentiated from consciousness. Once you, then the next, so now you have the sakshi. Consciousness is the sakshi, the witness of the mind. Up to that point, there's a sakshi. Mm-hmm. Then what you have to do is remove the mind, because in the subject-object relationship, the object is not, the subject is not dependent on the object, what's being illumined. So now you remove the object, the mind, and you're left with the sakshi, except the sakshi has nothing there to be a sakshi of. Mm-hmm. And so the sakshi, the idea of the sakshi, collapses when you remove the upadhi, mind. And so the sakshi only is a helpful tool that itself dissolves when that prakriya, when that teaching methodology reaches the point of awareness.
What do you mean by remove the mind, not use it?
No, no. It's like if I, just hypothetically, if I say, okay, I am not this microphone stand. I'm aware of it. I'm not it. So therefore, if I remove it, nothing happens to me. Because there's a subject-object relationship. I'm aware of it. If I get rid of it, it's irrelevant to my being. So then I, but this is an object outside of the body. Now I apply that same subject-object relationship to the body. Something that I illumine that I'm aware of, or I witness it changing, right? I witness the body change, but I don't change. Subject-object relationship, if I get rid of the body, then nothing happens to me. Just hypothetically, so you imagine now you're getting rid of the body. So same thing with sense organs. I'm aware of the sense organs. If something happens to the sense organs, I lose the capacity of the sense organs, that those capacities belong to the sense organs, but nothing happens to me. Like subject-object relationship. That's why, you know, you may lose a sense organ, but you don't lose yourself. You're the same self, but you don't have that tool. So then you can say, well, it's the mind that was aware of the sense organs, but now we get to the mind. Okay, I'm aware of the mind. Subject-object relationship. So now I get, hypothetically, I get rid of the mind. What happens to me? Nothing. But now we have to look at, once we get to the self that we're looking at from the standpoint of the mind, as the sakshi, as the witness, is the self, consciousness, a sakshi? As a witness, is it performing an act of witnessing? It's like a verb, right? It's a doer, it's a witnesser, it's a witness. Say, no, it's not performing any act. With what is it performing an act? There's no mind there. There's no. You need a mind, you need sense organs to be, you know, thinking or doing or engaged in focusing on something. Consciousness is called a witness from the standpoint of the mind to differentiate it from the mind, but when you've done that differentiation and then you remove the mind, you know, hypothetically with it as an object, then the sakshi is not a sakshi. It's just pure consciousness, pure being. So the sakshi resolves itself in that prakriya. You only use the term sakshi in reference to this particular teaching methodology. And then it goes away along with the methodology once you get to the awareness. See what I mean? Otherwise, you have to think of yourself as this eternal witness. You're always looking.
Always witnessing.
Always witnessing. But then we're all witnessing something different, right? Because you're witnessing your mind. How can we all be one self? Because different things are being witnessed. Well, different things are being witnessed, but from the standpoint of the mind, not from the standpoint of the self. And the ahankara, the I notion, is a thought in the of the mind. It's one of the four types of thoughts, you know. And so the mind says, "I am the conscious being." You know, I am the mind, the conscious being. That's the ahankara. That's born of ignorance.
When you say knower, I'm having kind of a tough time like understanding the definition of that. Is it, you mean like a subject? I mean like a. What? Because it's like, why is not the mind a knower? Is it because the mind is known by the by the sakshi?
It's not ultimately a knower. Mm-hmm. It is a knower from its own standpoint, but it is also known. Mm-hmm. So it's not the final knower. Mm-hmm. You know, like when they say pratyagatma, the innermost self. You know, it's not the innermost self, the mind, because the mind can be objectified, just like the body. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the sense organs are also a knower, but they're also an object. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So knower kind of gets replaced by instrument of knowing, because they're not the self. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As you say, once the ananda is recognized,
yeah,
it will never be lost. But because of strong habits, as though it seems to be lost.
No. Now, go ahead.
Will there be a time that the knowledge will overcome, the habits will dissipate, and there will be no sort of obstructions from those old habits?
I have to clear one thing up first. There are the ananda of, that is what is meant by the nature of the self, that doesn't come and go for a jnani or for an ajnani, but the ajnani doesn't recognize it because it hasn't been differentiated, but it never changes. The mental states for both a jnani and an ajnani do come and go. And so for a jnani, there can be more or less ananda or neutral or dull or all kinds of mental states going on there. For a jnani, the mental states become much simpler, much less extreme, because you're not asking the world to be your source of ananda, you know? And so the mind has much more equipoise because of that. Just like if you say you have no knowledge at all, no self-knowledge, but you're in a situation where everything's really fine. There are no problems. The environment is nice. The people are nice. There's enough money. There's good food. There's, you're in good health. Everything's working fine. And even if it doesn't last for very long, while that is lasting, there's just nothing disturbing that's causing you to ask the creation to be any different than what it is. Right? And so there's just a natural kind of well-being, because there's nothing at the moment that's really disturbing you. You're not asking the creation to be different. For jnani, there's much more of that. Much more of not asking the creation to be different. Because you don't depend upon the creation for creating an experience of shanti in the mind to give you that sense of well-being, because the mind is relaxing in the ananda of the self alone, which is really the only source. And when that's its natural point of relaxation, then that also makes the creation more interesting as Ishvara. So you enjoy much more equipoise of mind. Okay, so that in that way, yes, the mind becomes much calmer for somebody who has knowledge versus somebody who doesn't. But that is different. Those are still mental states that come and go, and they're much less tumultuous, because you yourself aren't asking the world to provide you with your ananda. You know, which is and that stance of, I need the world to give me this and this and this and this way and that way and this way, is born of ignorance, because you think that means that you think that the wholeness that you're seeking, actually the world could give it to you, which it can. It's absolutely incapable of that.
So the question is not seeking mental states, and I mean, that's a big turnaround, you know.
Yeah, you're not seeking the world to provide you with mental states.
Yeah.
You know, not that I don't like, you know.
Well, but we're designed to approach the world like that.
You are, but this is why, that's why what makes you a mumukshu versus somebody else. I mean, most people don't question that. But at some point you say, this isn't working. Mm. You know? Mm. It doesn't work.
sometime, somewhere.
You know, but some you realize, but what you realize is not, that's the thing. You realize not sometime, somewhere. Never. Never. Because of the nature of the world, you recognize it can give momentary mental states, happy states, which it does. But you realize it will never go beyond momentary. Because of the nature of the world, not that the world is mean, nothing like that. It's that the very nature of the world is subject to change. And so if you're dependent upon the world to provide you with something, you can't, you may be able to get that, but only for a moment, whatever moment, longer moment, shorter moment, because everything changes. Everything is subject to birth and death and change. And so, and you know that as soon as you say you really want something and you fulfill the desire and you have that moment of happiness, almost immediately crowded out by your concerns over being able to maintain that in this way or that way. But say, you're no longer subject, you're no longer under that, literally that delusion.
Yeah.
That the ananda that you seek belongs to the objects in the world. That rather it's the very source of, it is your being, in fact. And what allows the mind to have these sukha-vrittis have nothing, again, to do with the objects. It has to do with the relaxation of the mind. When the mind relaxes, it feels fine. You know, when it's tense, it feels terrible. You know, but we think, see, when you fulfill a desire, at that moment the mind relaxes because you got your way, you got what you want. The mind is relaxed, you feel happy, then you love the thing that made you happy. But that's not really what's going on.
So I'd like to ask a practical question that builds on that. Let's say, for example, you said right at the very end of your formal lecture, you said, and it's so obvious when it happens, or something like that, like when you, that suddenly there's that illumination about the reality of the self. And so as an example, let's say I'm meditating, and my mind gradually becomes more and more calm.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, it's very calm, so that if thoughts come, they're noticed pretty...
Yeah.
Almost immediately or immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And in between, things are very quiet. And there's a sense of awareness, but it's not the same kind of consciousness as waking awareness. My question is, at that point, I sometimes wonder, am I in a mental state of calmness, calm abiding, or am I actually experiencing just that illumination? I don't, for example, have an awareness that, oh, yes, this is it, you know. It's not obvious to me at that time that I've transcended all thought. What is obvious is that everything's quiet, and but I'm not in the same kind of mental state that I'm normally in as a fully functioning external world person. Is my question making any sense?
Yeah, I'm kind of regretting that I said that in that way, because...
Well, that's okay. I'm not trying to hold it out in any way.
What
did you say that you're regretting?
When I said that thing about it being obvious, because that can be mistaken from in another type of Neo-Vedanta type of talking, and I didn't mean it like that, and I remember when I said it, and I thought, I shouldn't have said that since I said it.
Well, I can let it go. It's not the essence of the question.
Yeah. No, but let me say like this. Yourself is fully, completely present, experientially, not as an object, but just as you, right now. Now, the mind is capable, in meditation, and even throughout the day, and through days like when you're walking through the in a beautiful park or something, you know, of having very subtle vrittis, thought modification, mm-hmm. very, very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Some profoundly subtle, more subtle than at other times, you know. And those are expansive, extraordinary experiences that are not your day-to-day experiences.
Right.
But those experiences, and there's many degrees of subtle types of spiritual experiences or meditative experiences, very different one from another, and not necessarily at all states that you're continually walking around with, because there's when the mind has takes on different forms of subtlety. But those are states, and they're brought about by subtle states of mind that come and go. Like the subtle, one day you have a very subtle state of mind, 2 hours later it's not as subtle as it was a few hours ago, that type of thing. And then it can just be just regular.
But sometimes the heavy vrittis are not so troublesome, is what you're saying. And I may be in a mind state that's very, only has subtle vrittis.
What I'm saying is that vrittis are vrittis. Some are subtle, some are gross. Sometimes there's heavier mind states than other times. I'm also saying that once one gains knowledge, there it does affect your state of mind. Because you're not asking the world to be the great provider of your ananda.
Right, I experience that.
Yeah, and so because of that, the mind becomes more calm. And I'm saying, in the world, even without knowledge, there are certain times in your life where everything's just kind of going along fine, and you don't need it to be a different way, and so, you know, there's a lot of more freedom, more shanti in the mind. But it's temporary because, you know, you can't hold that because in the end you really are dependent upon the world to be a particular way in order for you to be happy. That type of thing.
Why is
So for somebody who has knowledge, it becomes more natural.
Mm.
More natural to enjoy your own ananda, kind of reveling in your own ananda and enjoying the creation as Ishwara, enjoying your prarabdha, the life that you've been given. You know, and engaging in the world as it is without having it be a source of happiness for you.
Yeah, I guess I'm asking, is it possible for me to be, let's say, experiencing the self in its kind of pristine purity, usually in meditation, but sometimes, as you say, just boom.
No, what I'm saying is that the self-experience,
uh-huh.
not as an object, but just
uh-huh.
as you,
uh-huh.
the self of it, is fully experienced all the time.
Okay.
The vrittis, different types of vrittis,
mm-hmm.
reflect the self in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But the self-experience, the self-evident nature of your own being, is always fully, completely experienced. Not as an object, but as consciousness itself.
And would I know that if I were experiencing it?
You are experiencing it, and so you don't know it. Because it's getting confused with vrittis. Let me put it this way.
Well, that's kind of what I was asking.
Yeah. It is?
Well, as much as I can kind of communicate in words, you know, I mean, if you could just... give me the direct experience, that would be better. but
this is exactly it. The direct experience is already here. It has to be differentiated.
Right.
And see, I'll tell you, one of the big problems is that we, think of experience as a state of mind. In other words, I create an experience. I gain a thought modification of some sort, you know? And then I experience that. And then I work to gain that experience. So when I think of self-knowledge, I work to gain an experience of the self in the form of a thought modification. So then I have a subtle meditative thought modification, and that's an experience of the self. And I say, no, that's an experience of the subtle thought modification.
Mm-hmm.
The experience of the self is the one that is always present, whether there's a subtle thought modification or not. And because it's self-evident, self-luminous, it needs to be differentiated from both the subtle thought modification and the sad thought modification and the perception. And the problem is not that yourself is not fully self-evident right now. It is. But it's because of self-ignorance on the part of the mind, it's been superimposed upon the mind and the body. So we have to gain knowledge through the viveka, differentiation of your own stable presence from these different thoughts and perceptions.
Well, I'm demonstrating my ignorance in the question. I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I'm trying to make that differentiation at a very subtle level. Maybe I just need to keep meditating.
There's nothing wrong with the subtle levels, but what you should do, you can try, is that you have a profound meditation, and we enjoy those subtle states of experience because they're beautiful, they're wonderful.
Typically, they're, yeah. Very pleasurable.
Yeah. Now what you need to do is notice the one who's aware of that, who's present to it. And then when that state goes, you say you come out of your meditative state and you're washing your dishes. See if you can recognize the one that is here now, that was there.
Got it. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. It is helpful. Good, I'm glad.
Yeah.
Let's stop. Can we stop? Yeah. Okay.